The Dawn Recorded Lecture Service is pleased to present a session from the 2002 General Convention held at the University of Pittsburgh in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The speaker for this session was Brother Austin Williams, whose subject is, What Has Religion Done for Mankind?
And there are two important reasons why I'm here, brethren, and why I'm thankful to be in your midst. One is, of course, the Lord's providential overrulings in my life. And the second one, we'll wait till the end of the discourse, and I hope you'll remember to remind me. All successful people are good planners. If someone in the world asks you, are you successful? What would our answer be? However, we are talking from a worldly perspective. Invariably, the answer is based upon how strong and how sound one is successfully in terms of being financially successful. Sorry. That would determine the meaning of success. If I were asked, do you consider yourself a success? That was one of my first questions when I was working at IBM. I was asked. I didn't know what to answer them, but my boss taught me the answer, and he taught me the way as well. And my answer now is, my answer would be, I will consider myself successful if I'm fully aware of my mission. Based on a clear understanding of that mission, I would do reasonable research, plan, and finally execute. So, the intent and the objective of our thoughts today, brethren, is number one, to educate, number two, to prepare, and number three, which is most important, is appreciate immensely what has been revealed to us and not take it for granted, thus making us complacent in our most holy faith. We will try and analyze three religions in the time we have. Initially, I thought only two, but last night I scooped and made it into three. Which exceeds half the population of this world, our Adam's progeny. Hopefully it will help us to witness effectively after learning the definition of each religion, how it started, the basic tenets of their respective beliefs, and see if there's any virtue in these religions. And of course we have to study the source of documentation, and I don't believe our consecrated time is worth the while to study this documentation, and that's why I'm going to give it to you in hopefully in the 40 minutes. So, be with me, mentally see if you can transpose yourselves to a situation where you're listening to these kind of individuals with this persuasion and formulate in your minds, what would your witness approach be? And I'll give you some of my experiences, what my approach was and how wrong I was. Number one, the first religion we're going to take is Hinduism. Don't be surprised. How many out here know what about Hinduism, besides they worship the cow and full of idols? Don't raise your hands. I'll ask you the answer at the end of the discourse. It's interesting, brethren, the word Hindu was given by guess who? None other than Islam. Islam brought that word Hindu from Iran and termed it Hinduism. Can you believe that? And nevertheless, they did that because these were individuals who were living on the river, Sindhu it's called, and they were the inhabitants of the river. Islam, which brought it, it's the Persian word, Hindu. And of course, our English scholars simply called it Hinduism. Scholars, however, call this faith an eternal faith. For we shall see later as to attain the universal soul is the ultimate aim and goal of all Hindu thought. And of course, Hinduism was not started by an individual. They claim, and they say, it's just like Judaism. It's an ethnical religion, like old Greek or old Norse religion, existing from way back. When? I don't know. And of course, its population is estimated 1.2 billion worldwide. And Hinduism, they claim that it's a way of life because it combines great qualities of Catholicity. Now you may say Catholic, it simply means universal. The outlook and free thinking, even an atheist is not precluded to be a Hindu. Brethren, I learned all this recently myself. Because people kept asking me, thinking that I was a Hindu or a Muslim. So I said, you know what, I got to do some study about it because I don't know anything about it. And so, please bear with me as I'm reading, because this is not what I was raised with. Otherwise, I would have spoken extemporaneously, like Brother Jim Parkinson. Hinduism, which is claimed by Hindus as the oldest religion in the world, goes back about 5,000 years. And of course, most of Southeast Asia has been greatly influenced by this cultural ethos. Since there is no documentation and a belief of any beginning of mankind, I personally think it all began from the Tower of Babel. And India is the epitome of confusion, brethren. And I will mention some names at the end of the discourse. You ask them, because they were in India as well. The makeup of the religion, it's a faith with few do's and don'ts, with tremendous tolerance for other religious faiths and beliefs. So according to the book of Hinduism, this is how I quote, "Whosoever follows any faith and worships me under whatever denomination, in whatever form, with steadfastness, his faith shall I indeed reinforce." Most other religions say, your religion is wrong and to follow it is a sin. Get converted to my religion and heaven will be yours. And of course, what it simply implies is the Lord the Hindus worship simply says, it implies, come to me as a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Hindu. Guess what? I'll make you a better Jew, a Christian or a Hindu or a Muslim. So my Hindu friends tell me, you know, your Christianity is very exclusive. Ours is very inclusive. And I want to tell them, I've told them ours is also inclusive, but you wait. And that's one of the things when I get a chance to witness, I tell them, listen, you don't have to believe everything I say. I only ask of one thing from you, and that is, I hope you have a good memory and you remember what I say. That's all I tell them. And because of this kind of an outlook, Hinduism didn't begin with a lot of wars or conversion, and it's unique because they didn't give food for beggars to become Hindus. There was no coercion because of that. So a Hindu can worship in a church, a mosque, or a temple, no problem. And we'll see why. And of course, very few religious faiths do have such tolerant approach, or their priests will not let you go and worship in any other location. So Hinduism is not based on one book. It has four books. And the four books, they call it different names. I don't want to give you those names, brethren, because it's difficult for me to pronounce. You won't even understand, but I'll convert that in English. The first book is called Revealed, and it was revealed to a teacher or a prophet, and it was revealed through sages. The second book is called Remembered. These are human compositions which regulate and guide individuals in their daily conduct and list the codes and rules governing the actions of individuals, community, society, and the nation. However, since ordinary people cannot read or ability to read or understand these books, there's a third set of books, and they're called the mythology. And it's most of their beliefs, I can tell you, is based on this mythology and parables. And that's what guides a common man, woman, king, or a commoner. And the fourth set of books is a compilation of divinely inspired writings, which they also call it a hymn book, which they sing. And some of their stories or fables are passed down from generation to generation to a simple villager, a illiterate peasant, or a small child. The tenets and beliefs, this is important. And you can relate to what the adversary has done even with this religion. The three main functions of a Godhead, three functions of one Godhead. Does that sound familiar? Creator, preserver, and destroyer. The three different roles a creator plays determines what part or which part of the Godhead is doing what. And of course, we know what that is called, simply Trinity. The concept of God is everywhere is borne by these stories and fables, and hence recognition is given to animals, trees, stones, including this microphone. You name it, brethren, and it's considered incarnation of God, And that's why they feel each god can have many sub-incarnations. The reverence for plants and trees, they feel, is because of heavenly bodies reside in them. And so now they say, see, our religion way back taught ecology and environment. You guys are piling onto it now. We started way back. Last when I heard, brethren, when I say last, February 6th, there were more than 1.5 million gods. Now, it's intriguing. How could, if every stone, every tree, every aspect of is a god, how can it be only 1.5 million? Be that as it may, now you see why it's 1.5 million. And many of you have heard that reverence given to the cow and not killing it, it's simply based on the principle of not killing an animal which that provides largely a vegetarian nation with milk products for sustenance, akin to a mother providing food for her young. I will not mention, brethren, what they do with the liquid waste from the cow. It is too repulsive and hard to comprehend. Most Hindu homes have an altar to worship God. Every Hindu home has. And of course, they all have their most favorite gods. And I'll give you some few. The most popular one, of course, if you guessed it right, is the goddess of prosperity, money. It's a female incarnation of preserver. And of course, then we have the female incarnation of the creator, which is the goddess of learning and wisdom. And just branching off, the creator has 4 sons. And one of the sons has a head, a human body, an elephant head. It's the most popular god, by the way. And the trunk has a trunk of an elephant because the head is of an elephant. And the mode of transportation is a mouse. And the snake is around the waist. And it's depicting cosmic energy. And I'll tell you why I'm mentioning all this. Then you would understand why they have these gods, brethren. And then you can ask the brethren who've been to India. They've seen temples, I hope, with these kind of paraphernalia. The snake depicting the cosmic energy. The rat is symbolic of God's creation, a wisdom to include even the most insignificant creation of his creature, of his creation, sorry. Therefore, there is a temple in India to this day which is dedicated to rats. You walk in, the rodents are walking all over. And I'm telling you, I've never been, but I saw it on National Geographic. I was shocked. You want to know what is so repulsive? Human beings coexist with these rats, and milk is offered in a big, big cauldron for these rats, and after the rats have helped themselves, anything is remaining will be given to the human beings. That's a blessing. That's a blessing. And the colonialism of British rule in India still permeates. And that is the ultimate for any believer to come to that temple and witness one white mouse. Done. They have done their life and they've really received the blessings. And the priests say there's no bubonic plagues ever reported. And of course, whoever reported, I don't think so they survived. They couldn't survive. And of course, there's no contacts of rats from the outside to the inside. And similarly, monkey has become a god, a big god. Why? Because of the mythology, a righteous king had a fight with the devil, and guess what? He was wounded so badly, and the monkey was told to go get a specific herb from a mountain. The monkey didn't have enough time, and so guess what it did? It pulled out the whole mountain and brought it to the queen. And the queen found the proper herb and cured the king. That's why a monkey is also a god. Similarly, this is very dangerous. Listen to this one. A day set aside to worship a snake. A day set aside. Now, if you ever worked for a public company in India, brethren, I can tell you, you cannot work even a single day because with so many gods, every day there's a holiday. You could never go to work. Please go and work in India. You will have a holiday all through. They've set aside a day to worship a snake. Milk is poured over them, and I've seen this. Choicest food is prepared for these snakes. To top it all, brethren, the superstitious animal ritual takes place, which is so explicit, and the only way I can describe is Mark 3:23. How can Satan cast out Satan? You know what they do? The ritual is a king cobra. Many of you must have heard what a king cobra is. It's normally about 8 to 10, 12 foot long. When it injects the venom, brethren, it can kill 100 human beings. And the competition is, who can keep a king cobra in their mouth the longest? And the man who keeps it for the extended period of time shows how great a god the snake is in the form of reincarnation. That's the point, reincarnation. Now, I just see it as nothing but Satan casting out Satan. Similarly, they set a day aside for to worship the articles of livelihood. For example, a taxi driver put aside a day, cleans the taxi, worships it because that's the one which puts on the put food on the table. And similarly, the person who drives a bus, a doctor, an auto mechanic, or a carpenter, they worship everything. Here's another interesting concept. A typical Hindu temple consists of an entrance porch where devotees gather for worship. The next compartment is where the priest is situated, where the offerings to God is given to him, and in turn he takes it to the next compartment, the last compartment where the deity is installed. No one but the priest is allowed in there. Does this seem familiar to us from our tabernacle studies? Court, holy, and the most holy. Similarly, the river Ganges is very, very, very sacred to them because it's a river goddess which purifies them from all eternity and purity. And once in every 12 years, Jupiter and Earth lines up, and that's when they gather there in millions. December 2000 brought about 20 million people to a town which is smaller than Rutherford, you can imagine. Needless to say, I don't know how the impurities, how they get cured, but I've been there, and if you see the impurities of people washing clothes, taking a bath, cows being washed, they have to take a bath in this. So, if you had an opportunity to witness to somebody like of this persuasion, how would you start, brethren? Guess how I started? I started by saying, what is your hope for mankind? You know what one of the answers was? Well, your question is predicated upon the assumption that mankind and his progeny has no hope, and they are hopeless. Well, this is their rationale behind what they believe. Man is created, depending on his or her walk of life, dictates his or life fate. It's called cause and effect. And many of you have heard the word karma. That's what it is, cause and effect. What simply means is, it simply means if you do good in this present life, you will be reborn as a better human being in your next. This is the doctrine of transmigration of souls. The purpose of this rebirth is essentially to reward those with good deeds and punish those with bad deeds. This continuous cycle of births and rebirths is what they call the migration of souls. And eventually, you keep being born as a better human being, until, guess what? You become a part of the Creator. That's an objective of every Hindu. And here's one of their reasons, two reasons. They give you a good reason. A caterpillar which climbs a blade of a grass, leaves it, and jumps onto a new one as a butterfly. I simply call it metamorphosis. Just like a man changes worn-out garments and wears new ones, so does the soul cast away one body and takes on another. Therefore, Hindus by and large are very kind to animals because of this belief that the animal they're viewing was a human being before. I give you two real-life examples. We have a good family friend whose father recently passed away, and recently they started finding out that there was a crow which would come every morning and perch on their balcony in their apartment building. And they started feeding it, and they were convinced the father was resurrected, to lack of a better term, as a crow. The facts don't end there, brethren. Soon after the father died, one of his best friends, who was a Muslim, also died. Guess what happened? Two crows started coming every morning. I was laughing when I heard this, and how do I tell her that? But of course, I had to give her the gospel plan. She said, okay, that's your belief, this is my belief. And two crows started coming, they started feeding the two crows, father and the best friend. That's one example. Second example, 2 years ago in Bangkok, Thailand, this is a true story, it came on the world news as well. A boy died of a sudden death out of serious illness. At his funeral, a lizard watched the whole ritual, and the lizard slowly followed them home. After the completion of the ceremony, the family was convinced that their son was reincarnated instantly as this lizard. So much so, guess what they did with the lizard? They took him home, fed the lizard, and soon established that lizard only ate the best food the boy liked. And so the lizard got to sleep in the boy's bed because it was considered his reincarnated son. So similarly, they feel God came into this world reincarnated to destroy the wicked and protect the righteous. They believe that Jesus Christ is also an incarnation of God. Have you heard of the word called Krishna? It's nothing but Christ. That's what they say. And I want to touch upon what Brother Jim Parkinson said. So heaven is a place of bliss for them. No blister. Because man enters God's body. They don't believe in hell or doomsday. And so there is no turn and burn. The Hindus believe there are four ages, and each age is comprised of 28,000 years. And guess what? We are in the last age. We are in the last age. And guess what happens? This age is called the age of knowledge. And after comes another incarnation of God. Are you ready, brethren? On a white horse with white robes, who will establish a peaceful kingdom. This is their belief also. Now my question to them is, if everyone is going to become a part of the Creator, who's God going to rule on? Who are the subjects? I haven't got an answer yet. They have four caste systems, and it's very entrenched. And I will tell you the reason why I'm mentioning that. The caste system is so entrenched. The first race is the Brahmin race, which is purely vegetarian. They are the scholars, the scientists, the teachers, and the priests. The second race is the warrior race. The third race is the business class race. And the fourth race is the untouchable race. You're born into a race. You cannot convert yourself. And there's a lot of reformation which has begun because of that. There's one mission or one movement which has started questioning the fundamentals of Hinduism. And that is, number one, if a man is reincarnated as a crow, for example, when will the crow have enough time to repent and find out all the bad things that it did or to rectify and become a better human being if it's a crow? There's a lot of reformation going on amongst that. So the despotism of the caste system gave rise to the next religion in the 5th century called Buddhism. Can you believe it exceeds Hinduism in terms of population? It began in India as well. Buddhism, as Brother Russell put it in Ripon article, he called it simply the Protestantism of India. That's all he called it. And when I looked at it, you know why. I'll briefly mention that and then we'll move on to the next one. Though born in India, it has a very little sway. They're more spreading into China, Japan, Tibet, Vietnam. It extends up to Siberia and Sweden. And as I mentioned, it population is about 1.3 billion. It started by one individual. And the word Buddha is not a title. It's not a name, sorry, it's a title. It means enlightened or awakened. Because of this definition, the historical person who they always think of and the title used is a prince who was born in a palace, and he gave up all this because they saw two polarization of two main currents of Hinduism. The right wing dominated by the priest and the left wing dominated by ascetics, who are basically, they renounce all their family life, public career, and seemingly leave the society. As like every right and left wing groups, their opposition was against the establishment of Hinduism. Because of the deep caste system, the warrior race and the Brahmin race did not agree on which one should be regarded as a superior to the other. In such a situation, the secular rulers, normally the warrior race, supported the ascetics, and to get a counterbalance to the Brahmin's strong position of the spiritual pecking order. I'll quickly move on to what the Buddhists believe. The center of Buddhism comprises of three things: teaching. First is the teacher, second is the teaching, and third is fellowship. A lot of importance is given to the teacher. And Buddhism, number one, it's a philosophy, not a theology. I'll tell you why. Number one, they don't believe there is a God. And they don't recognize that there's a supernatural power up there. Man is supposedly capable of attaining this power by virtue of austerity and wisdom. Disgusted with the many gods of Hinduism and the priestcraft, they imposed their beliefs on the superstitious people. And they began with a good ideology, and their only focus is wisdom and personal virtue. And it discards all ideas and necessity of priesthood and does away with all caste. Instead of a god, they set up an ideal character, which they term Buddha, not for worship, but for the imitation of mankind. You see a clarity, there's one end of the spectrum which has millions of gods, and comes another end of the spectrum, absolutely no god whatsoever. The philosophy, number one, logical reason. Listen to this, brethren. Buddhism does not accept the idea of an omnipotent creator, God, because if God is omnipotent, he cannot accept the fact that he can create and make a rule, such as he created a stone that is so heavy that God himself cannot lift it. Hence, Buddhism recommends us to live here now and to give a meaning to our life, not to lose ourselves in speculation about that which we don't know. That's a logical reason. An ethical reason. God has power but no responsibility, whereas man has all responsibility but no power. Buddhism does not accept such a separation of power and responsibility. If one being had all the power there is, he would by necessity also have all the guilt there is. So the logical conclusion is, if you're ever worshiping an omnipotence, is really kind of a worship of devil. Praying to an almighty being means kneeling down to evil, consciously or unconsciously. I can go on and on, brethren, but I just want to stress on a few points. Buddhism says the world is not ruled according to a divine plan. They don't believe in a divine plan. That means it doesn't mean that it is ruled by a chance either, like the Hindus believe in karma, cause and effect. They also believe similar to that, and that is they believe in natural laws. Why? Because even science does not know everything. That's the reason. Although there's a difference, major difference between Hindus and Muslims, we always talk about amongst brotherhood, there's a baggage they carry. You know what the baggage is? They believe that there are numerous heavens for the good according to their merits, and about 136 hells situated inside the earth for the wicked, which are separated according to the deeds. It lays heavy emphasis on controlled meditation and morality. Morality, of course, supersedes meditation. I'll give you one example of what meditation is. National Geographic, again, assembled few monks in the Himalayas, Mount Himalayas, with just a loincloth, sub-freezing temperatures, gave them wet bed sheets. And before you know, the bed sheets were dry. And they showed it all live, I remember. And so the point they're making is, it's mind over body, and hence yoga. What it simply means, the Hindus believe the yoga is a way to become a part of the Creator. And of course, the yoga we see these days is for better health and meditation and so on and so forth. That's how it all began. Continuing, fellowship has a lot of bearing also. Buddhists believe that Buddha and Christ taught the same principles. In fact, they believe that Buddha and Christ led a parallel lives. They even go to say, as far as saying that Jesus Christ was taught or was trained in Buddhism. I want to know why. How? Because this Buddha was born 500 years before Christ. He was 5,000 miles apart. I don't know how he was taught. Jesus was taught by this Buddha. However, to this day, there is a statue of Buddha and Christ in Vietnam where side by side, apparently depicting the lamentations over the plight of humanity. And so that's the reason why they believe. Two reasons why they believe that Christ was trained by Buddhism. Jesus said, Matthew 19:21, "If thou wilt be perfect, go and sell that thou hast and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me." What did Buddha say? "The avaricious do not go to heaven, the foolish do not extol charity, the wise men, however, rejoicing in charity becomes thereby happy in the beyond." Matthew 17:20, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Guess what Buddha said? A monk who is skilled in concentration can cut the Himalayas mountain into two. Moving on, our time is nearing. Let's move on to Islam. I'm sure you're all curious to know what Islam is all about. It all began 5th century by a man called Muhammad. It simply means messenger of God. And he was born of descendants of Abraham and Hagar. We'll come to that later. Just a brief perusal of the map in Arabia tells us that the peninsula was lying in the confluence of three great continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe. At the time in question, people of settled habitations were, in this land, were nomads. They inhabited this extensive Arabian subcontinent composed mostly of desert areas. The means of subsistence in Arabia were meager. The desert had its handicaps. Trade caravans were features of great importance than either agriculture or industry. Of course, this entailed much travel of men. They had to proceed through peninsula to Syria, Egypt, Abyssinia, Iraq, India, Afghanistan. From the point of view of religion, Arabia was idolatrous. Only few individuals followed Christianity. The Meccans did possess the notion of one God. However, they believed also that the idols had the power to intercede with them. Curiously enough, they did not believe in the resurrection and afterlife. They had preserved the right of pilgrimage to where Abraham instituted something called, they call it Kaaba. And then you see sometimes on the TV where they're walking around in Medina, where this is the imputation of Abraham's installation of this edifice. In spite of comparative poverty, these individuals who grew up there had a lot of culture in the sense, not in terms of something they can pass it on, but they were pretty good in art and poetry. Women were generally treated well. They enjoyed the privilege of possessing property in their own right. They gave their consent to marriage contract in which they could even add the condition of reserving their right to divorce their husbands. They could remarry when widowed or divorced. It was in the midst of such conditions and environments that Muhammad was born, AD 570. And of course, the descendant of Abraham and Hagar was Egyptian. His father died when he was a few weeks old, and his grandfather took over the role of father. Soon he lost his mother. And of course, by the 8th birthday, his grandfather also died, and his uncle took care of him. And his uncle was not a man with a lot of means. Hence, at the age of 10, by the age of 10, he was earning his own living. By the time he was 20, he had become well known in the city where he was, known for his integrity and his disposition of honesty and his character. A rich widow took him as an employee and sent him with her goods to sell in Syria. When he came back with unusual profits, she obtained, what she did was she gave her hand to him, she married him. And so at the age of 40, she was married. We don't know what age he was married. So not much of his life has been given, except he received the revelation when he was 40 years old. And the revelation was at the end of the month of Ramadan, an angel came to him and announced that God had chosen him personally as his messenger to all mankind. The angel taught him the mode of washing away sins called ablutions, and the way of worshiping God and the conduct of prayer. There was a respite for 3 years where he was mocked, thinking that God had forsaken him, but this is the time where he recognized, spent time with prayers and spiritual practices. I want to move forward quickly because I want to get to what they really believe. The mission of Muhammad was to preach Quran, and that is believe in one God, transcendent God, believe in resurrection, number three, and the last judgment. And he took necessary steps to write this book for 23 years called Quran, which simply means recite or read. And he called this religion, of course, Islam, which simply means submission to the will of God. After the World Trade Towers collapse, many people are very curious as to what Islam is all about and what does it relate when it says peace, and is it really peaceful if they're specifically targeting those who support Israel and want to destroy those who support them, no matter what. Is it according to their faith? Is this what Islam teaches? We would simply present some of the Quranic verses and then we would stop. According to Quran, these are the quotes, brethren, right from Quran. Fight and slay the pagans, non-Muslims, wherever you find them. Chapter 9, verse 5. Go ye forth, strive, jihad, and struggle with your goods and your persons in the case of Allah, in the cause of Allah, sorry. Jihad, of course, they call it as a holy war. They also interpret it as struggle. And of course, the struggle is to worship, the freedom of worship. According to the Quran, there should not be another religion besides Islam in the universe. If anyone desires a religion other than Islam, never will it be accepted of him. And hereafter, he will be in the ranks of those who are lost. Chapter 3, verse 85. So what does Islam speak about the people of the book? You know what? The Arabic book, the book simply, the definition of book means somebody who's a Christian or a Jew. That's what it means. Fight those who believe not in God, nor the last day, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, and fight people of the book until they pay taxes with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Chapter 9, verse 29. People of the book lead you astray, not you, but themselves. They would render you apostates. O ye who believe, take not the Jews and Christians for your friends and protectors. They are but friends and protectors of each other. And he amongst you that turns to them for friendship is of them. Verily, Allah is not unjust to the people. So, the purpose of why they believe what they believe is because of these verses. Strike terror in the hearts of the enemies of God and your enemies. Quote from Quran, chapter 8, verse 60. Why do the Muslims feel Christians and Jews are infidels? According to the Quran, number one, Christ is not crucified. Chapter 4, verse 157. But Christians change the word of God. Muslims do not believe in the Trinity, but Christians made it themselves. Chapter 4, verse 171. No need for Christ's sacrifice. Allah can forgive whom he pleases and punishes whom he pleases. And of course, with the Jews, we go back to the days of Ishmael. The hatred began way back there because they're two half-brothers. And what happens to a person who converts to Islam, then changes his mind? I quote the Quran, you face death. Simple as that. So Islam does not teach equality of people. In fact, Islam teaches that Muslims are superior to all others. Here's the quote. Ye, Muslims are the best of people evolved for mankind. No assurance for salvation is Islam. The only assurance for a Muslim to go to heaven is through fighting for the cause of spreading Islam and being martyred in the process. And I tell you, brethren, those individuals who took the planes wherever they were consecrated to this belief, no question. I can continue on in terms of the five things they believe and so on and so forth. I just want to move on further and tell you two things they believe. They believe that the soul has two separate entities. They believe that a prophet, I'm speaking Arabic now, Isa as Salam, it simply means Jesus the prophet. They believe Jesus is a prophet who is going to come back. And if you don't hear him, you will be punished and destroyed. According to their teachings, Jesus will reign for 40 years, after which one day is set aside for judgment, and he will resuscitate all from their graves, especially those who have accepted Islam as their religion, Muhammad as their prophet, and Quran as their guide, will be rewarded. Since the believers and the unbelievers cannot be the equals, the former will go to paradise, and the latter will go to hell. They don't know where hell is. So, what is the point? What is the lesson for us in the few minutes we have? The lesson, brethren, I can give you a lot of experiences about. Imagine if you're a Bible student in an environment which is so infiltrated with these kind of people. There are brethren in India who are converted from Islam, from Hinduism. I haven't met anybody from Buddhism. I don't see why not, but I haven't met them personally. I want to give you experiences of certain brethren who are converted, and I'll just give you one before we close, and that is This brother, we met them this time in our recent visit with the Gorekis and Austins, and I didn't even know why he was so articulate, and it turned out that he was a Muslim convert, and his whole family disowned him, there's no question. Luckily, they didn't put him to death. If he was in an Islamic nation, he would have been gone. However, the family made sure that his boss was told that he converted to Christianity. He was fired from work. The family follows him to this day as to where he goes. So he goes and leaves his bicycle at a friend's house, and a brother picks him and takes him to the meeting. I'm just giving you some experiences as to what these individuals went through. So, what has religion done for mankind? Brethren, I cannot put it in any which way, but simply put, it has become such a popular omnibus. What does that mean? It's a large bus for conveying passengers whose driver is Satan. And hence it's called Satan's Omnibus, which has a seat and place for every religion, meaning something for everyone. Whether it's a Buddhist, agnostic, atheist, no problem. This is how he's blinded the world. And how long, brethren? We know how long it's going to be. Habakkuk 2:14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. No one in the kingdom, I can give you two illustrations, will say, that's a broken clock. You know, even though it's broken, it shows the time at least twice a day correctly. No one can do that. The other, you can relate to this one, which is a Wall Street phenomenon. It's called a roach approach. You all wonder what that is. You know what roach approach is simply? One roach decided to come out, and it turned out to be Enron. There are 100 roaches behind the refrigerator. That won't happen in the kingdom, brethren, because the knowledge of the Lord will cover the deep, as the waters cover the deep. And Philippians 2:10, that at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow, of those which are in heaven and on earth and on the earth. And last scripture I want to quote, brethren, I have many. And I like the principle which Jesus used in Acts 16:14. And he's referring to our sister Lydia. And he said, and a certain woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. We are talking about this principle in the kingdom. How wonderful that kingdom would be. And so, when presented with an opportunity to witness to these kind of individuals, guess what do I do? I'm looking forward to go home. You wonder, why this guy want to go home instead of witnessing? You know why I want to go home, brethren? I want to go down on my knees. And that's the second reason why I'm thankful for, is I could have been one of these. Each one of us can look back in our own lineage or history as to where we came from. We could have been this omnibus. We could be riding this omnibus. But guess what? The Lord has seen fit. Each one of us, there's a reason why the Lord saw to be here and be called as a Bible student, as brethren. And my only prayer is that we draw inspiration from those ancient worthies. Think of them. They were individuals. They didn't gather like you and I gathered together in a convention. They were one here, one there, where they were surrounded by heathenism and idolatry all the time. But guess what? They always worshiped one and true living God. And that's my prayer to you, and that is we could worship that true and living God and draw inspiration that when we see all these things around us, what manner of people we ought to be, brethren. I like the convention theme text. May the Lord add his blessings and forgive anything which was said or done amiss.
May the Lord bless thee and keep thee and make his face to shine upon thee. Amen.